Sandinistas was to use the tactics the agency, the CIA, attributed to communist insurgencies elsewhere. Kill, kidnap, rob, and torture. Many civilians were killed in cold blood. Many others were tortured, mutilated, raped, robbed, or otherwise abused. When I agreed to join, I had hoped that it would be an organization of Nicaraguans. It turned out to be an instrument of the U.S. government. There was a reason for the secrecy of the U.S. actions in Nicaragua. Public opinion surveys showed that the American public was opposed to military involvement there. In 1984, the CIA, using Latin American agents to conceal its involvement, put mines in the harbors of Nicaragua to blow up ships. When information leaked out, Secretary of Defense Weinberger told ABC News, "The United States is not mining the harbors of Nicaragua." Later that year, Congress, responding perhaps to public opinion and the memory of Vietnam, made it illegal for the United States to support, directly or indirectly, military or paramilitary operations in Nicaragua. The Reagan administration decided to ignore this law and to find ways to fund the Contras secretly, looking for third-party support. Reagan himself solicited funds from Saudi Arabia, at least $32 million. The friendly dictatorship in Guatemala was used to get arms surreptitiously to the Contras. Israel, dependent on U.S. aid and always dependable for support, was also used. In 1986, a story appearing in a Beirut magazine created a sensation that weapons had been sold by the United States to Iran, supposedly an enemy, that in return, Iran had promised to release hostages being held by extremist Muslims in Lebanon, and that profits from the sale were being given to the Contras to buy arms. When asked about this at a press conference in November 1986, President Reagan told four lies: that the shipment to Iran consisted of a few token anti-tank missiles, in fact, 2,000. That the United States didn't condone shipments by third parties, that weapons had not been traded for hostages, and that the purpose of the operation was to promote a dialogue with Iranian moderates. In reality, the purpose was a double one: to free hostages and get credit for that, and to help the Contras. The previous month, when a transport plane that had carried arms to the Contras was downed by Nicaraguan gunfire, and the American pilot captured, the lies had multiplied. Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams lied. Secretary of State Shultz lied. No connection with the U.S. government at all. Evidence mounted that the captured pilot was working for the CIA. The whole Iran-Contra affair became a perfect example of the double line of defense of the American establishment. The first defense is to deny the truth. If exposed, the second defense is to investigate, but not too much. The press will publicize, but they will not get to the heart of the matter. Once the scandal was out in the open, neither the congressional investigating committees, nor the press, nor the trial of Colonel Oliver North, who oversaw the Contra aid operation, got to the critical questions. What is U.S. foreign policy all about? How are the president and his staff permitted to support a terrorist group in Central America to overthrow a government that, whatever its faults, is welcomed by its own people as a great improvement over the terrible governments the U.S. has supported there for years? What does the scandal tell us about democracy, about freedom of expression, about an open society? Out of the much-publicized Contragate scandal came no powerful critique of secrecy in government or of the erosion of democracy by actions taken in secret by a small group of men safe from the scrutiny of public opinion. The media, in a country priding itself on its level of education and information, kept the public informed only on the most superficial level. The limits of Democratic Party criticism of the affair were revealed by a leading Democrat, Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who, as the investigation was getting underway, said, "We must, all of us, help the president restore his credibility in foreign affairs. A few Democrats were critical, which was deplored by a Harvard professor, James Q. Wilson, who was a member of Reagan's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Wilson looked back nostalgically to a bipartisan consensus, the equivalent of the one-party system in a totalitarian state. He worried most about a lack of resolve to act like a great power. It became clear that President Reagan and Vice President Bush were involved in what became known as the Iran-Contra affair, but their underlings scrupulously kept them out of it, illustrating the familiar government device of plausible denial, in which the top official, shielded by subordinates, can plausibly deny involvement. Although Congressman Henry Gonzalez of Texas introduced a resolution for the impeachment of Reagan, it was quickly suppressed in Congress. Neither Reagan nor Bush were indicted. Rather, the Congressional Committee put the lesser culprits on the witness stand, and several of them were indicted. One, Robert McFarlane, a former National Security Advisor to Reagan, tried to commit suicide. Another, Colonel Oliver North, stood trial for lying to Congress, was found guilty, but was not sentenced to prison. Reagan retired in peace, and Bush became the next president of the United States. In an ironic twist, an obscure citizen of the tiny town of Odon, Indiana, became a tangential actor in the Iran-Contra controversy. This was a young man named Bill Breeden, a former minister who lived in a teepee in the woods with his wife and two children, teaching the children at home. Breeden's hometown of Odon was also the hometown of Admiral John Poindexter, McFarlane's successor as Reagan's National Security Advisor, who was heavily involved in the illegal activities of the Iran-Contra affair. One day, Bill Breeden noticed that the town, to show its pride in its homeboy, had renamed one of its streets John Poindexter Street. Breeden, a pacifist and critic of U.S. foreign policy, indignant at what he thought was a celebration of immoral behavior in government, stole the sign. He announced that he was holding it ransom, $30 million, the amount of money that had been given to Iran for transfer to the Contras. He was apprehended, put on trial, and spent a few days in jail. As it turned out, Bill Breeden was the only person to be imprisoned as a result of the Iran-Contra affair. The Iran-Contra affair was only one of the many instances in which the government of the United States violated its own laws in pursuit of some desired goal in foreign policy. Toward the end of the Vietnam War in 1973, Congress, seeking to limit the presidential power that had been used so ruthlessly in Indochina, passed the War Powers Act, which said, "The President, in every possible instance, shall consult with Congress before introducing United States armed forces into hostilities or into situations where imminent involvement in hostilities is clearly indicated by the circumstances." Almost immediately, President Gerald Ford violated the act when he ordered the invasion of a Cambodian island and the bombing of a Cambodian town in retaliation for the temporary detention of American merchant seamen on the ship Mayaguez. He did not consult Congress before he gave the attack orders. In the fall of 1982, President Reagan sent American Marines into a dangerous situation in Lebanon, where a civil war was raging, again ignoring the requirements of the War Powers Act. The following year, over 200 of those Marines were killed when a bomb was exploded in their barracks by terrorists. Shortly after that, in October 1983, with some analysts concluding this was done to take attention away from the Lebanon disaster, Reagan sent U.S. forces to invade the tiny Caribbean island of Grenada. Again, Congress was notified, but not consulted. The reasons given to the American people for this invasion, officially called Operation Urgent Fury, were that a recent coup that had taken place in Grenada put American citizens, students at a medical school on the island, in danger, and that the United States had received an urgent request from the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States to intervene. An unusually pointed article in the New York Times on October 29, 1983, by correspondent Bernard Gwertzman, demolished those reasons. The formal request that the U.S. and other friendly countries provide military help was made by the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States last Sunday at the request of the United States, which wanted to show proof that it had been requested to act under terms of that group's treaty. The wording of the formal request, however, was drafted in Washington and conveyed to the Caribbean leaders by special American emissaries. Both Cuba and Grenada, when they saw that American ships were heading for Grenada, sent urgent messages promising that American students were safe and urging that an invasion not occur. There is no indication that the administration made a determined effort to evacuate the Americans peacefully. Officials have acknowledged that there was no inclination to try to negotiate with the Grenadian authorities. "We got there just in time," the president said. "A major point in the dispute is whether, in fact, the Americans on the island were in such danger as to warrant an invasion. No official has produced firm evidence that the Americans were being mistreated or that they should not be able to leave if they wanted." The real reason for the invasion, one high American official told Gwertzman, was that the United States should show, determined to overcome the sense of defeat in Vietnam, that it was a truly powerful nation. What good are maneuvers and shows of force if you never use it? The connection between U.S. military intervention and the promotion of capitalist enterprise had always been especially crass in the Caribbean. As for Grenada, an article in the Wall Street Journal 8 years after the military invasion, October 29, 1991, spoke of an invasion of banks, and noted that St. George's, the capital of Grenada, with 7,500 people, had 118 offshore banks, one for every 64 residents. St. George's has become the Casablanca of the Caribbean, a fast-growing haven for money laundering, tax evasion, and assorted financial fraud. After a study of various U.S. military interventions, political scientist Stephen Shalom, Imperial Alibis, concluded that people in the invaded countries died not to save U.S. nationals, who would have been far safer without U.S. intervention, but so that Washington might make clear that it ruled the Caribbean and that it was prepared to engage in a paroxysm of violence to enforce its will. He continued, "There have been some cases where American citizens were truly in danger. For example, the four churchwomen who were killed by the government-sponsored death squads in El Salvador in 1980. But there was no U.S. intervention there, no marine landings, no protective bombing raids. Instead, Washington backed the death squad regime with military and economic aid, military training, intelligence sharing, and diplomatic support." The historic role of the United States in El Salvador, where 2% of the population owned 60% of the land, was to make sure governments were in power that would support U.S. business interests, no matter how this impoverished the great majority of people. Popular rebellions that would threaten these business arrangements were to be opposed. When a popular uprising in 1932 threatened the military government, the United States sent a cruiser and two destroyers to stand by, while the government massacred 30,000 Salvadorans. The administration of Jimmy Carter did nothing to reverse this history. It wanted reform in Latin America, but not revolution that would threaten U.S. corporate interests. In 1980, Richard Cooper, a State Department expert on economic affairs, told Congress that a more equitable distribution of wealth was desirable. "However, we also have an enormous stake in the continuing smooth functioning in the economic system. Major changes in the system can have important implications for our own welfare." In February 1980, El Salvador Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero sent a personal letter to President Carter asking him to stop military aid to El Salvador. Not long before that, the National Guard and National Police had opened fire on a crowd of protesters. Not long before that, the National Guard and National Police had opened fire on a crowd of protesters in front of the Metropolitan Cathedral and killed 24 people. But the Carter administration continued the aid. The following month, Archbishop Romero was assassinated. There was mounting evidence that the assassination had been ordered by Roberto d'Aubuisson, a leader of the right wing. But d'Aubuisson had the protection of Nicolas Carranza, a deputy minister of defense, who at the time was receiving $90,000 a year from the CIA. And Elliot Abrams, ironically Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, declared that d'Aubuisson was not involved in the murder. When Reagan became president, military aid to the El Salvador government rose steeply. From 1946 to 1979, total military aid to El Salvador was $16.7 million. In Reagan's first year in office, the figure rose to $82 million. Congress was sufficiently embarrassed by the killings in El Salvador to require that before any more aid was given, the president must certify that progress in human rights was taking place. Reagan did not take this seriously. On January 28, 1982, there were reports of a government massacre of peasants in several villages. The following day, Reagan certified that the Salvadoran government was making progress in human rights. 3 days after certification, soldiers stormed the homes of poor people in San Salvador, dragged out 20 people, and killed them. When at the end of 1983, Congress passed a law to continue the requirement of certification, Reagan vetoed it. The press was especially timid and obsequious during the Reagan years. As Mark Hertstad documents in his book, On Bended Knee, when journalist Raymond Bonner continued to report on the atrocities in El Salvador and on the U.S. role, the New York Times removed him from his assignment. Back in 1981, Bonner had reported on the massacre of hundreds of civilians in the town of El Mazote by a battalion of soldiers trained by the United States. The Reagan administration scoffed at the account. But in 1992, a team of forensic anthropologists began unearthing skeletons from the site of the massacre, most of them children. The following year, a UN commission confirmed the story of the massacre at El Mazote. The Reagan administration, which did not appear at all offended by military juntas governing in Latin America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Chile, if they were friendly to the United States, became very upset when a tyranny was hostile, as was the government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. In 1986, when unknown terrorists bombed a discotheque in West Berlin, killing a U.S. serviceman, the White House immediately decided to retaliate. Gaddafi was probably responsible for various acts of terrorism over the years, but there was no real evidence that in this case he was to blame. Reagan was determined to make a point. Planes were sent over the capital city of Tripoli with specific instructions to aim at Gaddafi's house. The bombs fell on a crowded city. Perhaps 100 people were killed. It was estimated by foreign diplomats in Tripoli. Gaddafi was not injured, but an adopted daughter of his was killed. Professor Stephen Shalom, analyzing this incident, writes, Imperial Alibis, "If terrorism is defined as politically motivated violence perpetrated against non-combatant targets, then one of the most serious incidents of international terrorism of the year was precisely this U.S. raid on Libya." Early in the presidency of George Bush, there came the most dramatic developments on the international scene since the end of World War II. In the year 1989, with a dynamic new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, at the head of the Soviet Union, the long-suppressed dissatisfaction with dictatorships of the proletariat, which had turned out to be dictatorships over the proletariat, erupted all through the Soviet bloc. There were mass demonstrations in the Soviet Union and in the countries of Eastern Europe, which had been long dominated by the Soviet Union. East Germany agreed to unite with West Germany, and the wall separating East Berlin from West Berlin, long a symbol of the tight control of its citizens by East Germany, was dismantled in the presence of wildly exultant citizens of both Germanies. In Czechoslovakia, a new non-communist government came into being, headed by a playwright and former imprisoned dissident named Václav Havel. In Poland, Bulgaria, Hungary, a new leadership emerged, promising freedom and democracy. And remarkably, all this took place without civil war, in response to overwhelming popular demand. In the United States, the Republican Party claimed that the hardline policies of Reagan and the increase in military expenditures had brought down the Soviet Union. But the change had begun much earlier, after the death of Stalin in 1953, and especially with the leadership of Nikita Khrushchev. A remarkably open discussion had been initiated. But the continued hard line of the United States became an obstacle to further liberalization, according to former ambassador to the Soviet Union, George Kennan, who wrote that the general effect of Cold War extremism was to delay rather than hasten the great change that overtook the Soviet Union by the end of the 1980s. While the press and politicians in the United States exulted over the collapse of the Soviet Union, Kennan pointed out that not only did American policies delay this collapse, but these Cold War policies were carried on at a frightful cost to the American people. We paid with 40 years of enormous and otherwise unnecessary military expenditures. We paid through the cultivation of nuclear weaponry to the point where the vast and useless nuclear arsenal had become and remains today a danger to the very environment of the planet. The sudden collapse of the Soviet Union left the political leadership of the United States unprepared. Military interventions had been undertaken in Korea and Vietnam with enormous loss of life, also in Cuba and the Dominican Republic, and huge amounts of military aid had been given all over the world. In Europe, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, on the supposition that this was necessary to deal with a communist menace emanating from the Soviet Union. Several $1 trillion had been taken from American citizens in the form of taxes to maintain a huge nuclear and non-nuclear arsenal and military bases all over the world, all primarily justified by the Soviet threat. Here, then, was an opportunity for the United States to reconstruct its foreign policy and to free hundreds of billions of dollars a year from the budget to be used for constructive, healthy projects. But this did not happen. Along with the exultation, "We have won the Cold War," came a kind of panic. What can we do to maintain our military establishment? It became clearer now, although it had been suspected, that United States foreign policy was not simply based on the existence of the Soviet Union, but was motivated by fear of revolution in various parts of the world. The radical social critic Noam Chomsky had long maintained that the appeal to security was largely fraudulent, the Cold War framework having been employed as a device to justify the suppression of independent nationalism, whether in Europe, Japan, or the Third World, world orders old and new. The fear of independent nationalism was that this would jeopardize powerful American economic interests. Revolutions in Nicaragua or Cuba or El Salvador or Chile were threats to United Fruit, Anaconda Copper, International Telephone and Telegraph, and others. Thus, foreign interventions presented to the public as in the national interest were really undertaken for special interests, for which the American people were asked to sacrifice their sons and their tax dollars. The CIA now had to prove it was still needed. The New York Times, February 4, 1992, declared that, "In a world where the post-war enemy has ceased to exist, the CIA and its handful of sister agencies with their billion-dollar satellites and mountains of classified documents must somehow remain relevant in the minds of Americans." The military budget remained huge. The Cold War budget of $300 billion was reduced by 7% to $280 billion. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, said, "I want to scare the hell out of the rest of the world. I don't say that in a bellicose way." As if to prove that the gigantic military establishment was still necessary, the Bush administration in its four-year term launched two wars, a small one against Panama and a massive one against Iraq. Coming into office in 1989, George Bush was embarrassed by the new defiant posture of Panama's dictator, General Manuel Noriega. Noriega's regime was corrupt, brutal, authoritarian. But President Reagan and Vice President Bush had overlooked this because Noriega was useful to the United States. He cooperated with the CIA in many ways, such as offering Panama as a base for Contra operations against the Sandinista government of Nicaragua, and meeting with Colonel Oliver North to discuss sabotage targets in Nicaragua. When he was director of the CIA in 1976-1977, Bush had protected Noriega. But by 1987, Noriega's usefulness was over. His activities in the drug trade were in the open, and he became a convenient target for an administration which wanted to prove that the United States, apparently unable to destroy the Castro regime or the Sandinistas or the revolutionary movement in El Salvador, was still a power in the Caribbean. Claiming that it wanted to bring Noriega to trial as a drug trafficker, he had been indicted in Florida on that charge, and also that it needed to protect U.S. citizens. A military man and his wife had been threatened by Panamanian soldiers. The United States invaded Panama in December 1989 with 26,000 troops. It was a quick victory. Noriega was captured and brought to Florida to stand trial, where he was subsequently found guilty and sent to prison. But in the invasion, neighborhoods in Panama City were bombarded and hundreds, perhaps thousands of civilians were killed. It was estimated that 14,000 were homeless. Writer Mark Hertzgard noted that even if the official Pentagon figure of several hundred civilian casualties was correct, this meant that in Panama, the U.S. had killed as many people as did the Chinese government in its notorious attack on student demonstrators at Tiananmen Square in Beijing 6 months earlier. A new president friendly to the United States was installed in Panama, but poverty and unemployment remained. And in 1992, the New York Times reported that the invasion and removal of Noriega failed to stanch the flow of illicit narcotics through Panama. The United States, however, succeeded in one of its aims, to reestablish its strong influence over Panama. The Times reported, "The president of Panama and his key aides and the American ambassador, Dean Hinton, have breakfast together once a week in a meeting that many Panamanians view as the place where important decisions are taken." Liberal Democrats, John Kerry and Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, and many others, declared their support of the military action. The Democrats were being true to their historic role as supporters of military intervention, anxious to show that foreign policy was bipartisan. They seemed determined to show they were as tough or as ruthless as the Republicans. But the Panama operation was on too small a scale to accomplish what both the Reagan and Bush administrations badly wanted. To overcome the American public's abhorrence, since Vietnam, of foreign military interventions. 2 years later, the Gulf War against Iraq presented such an opportunity. Iraq, under the brutal dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, had taken over its small but oil-rich neighbor, Kuwait, in August 1990. George Bush needed something at this point to boost his popularity among American voters. The Washington Post, October 16, 1990, had a front-page story headline, "Poll Shows Plunge in Public Confidence, Bush's Rating Plummets." The Post reported, October 28, "Some observers in his own party worry that the president will be forced to initiate combat to prevent further erosion of his support at home." On October 30th, a secret decision was made for war in Iraq. The United Nations had responded to the invasion of Kuwait by establishing sanctions against Iraq. Witness after witness testified before congressional committees in the fall of 1990 that the sanctions were having an effect and should continue. Secret CIA testimony to the Senate affirmed that Iraq's imports and exports had been reduced by more than 90% because of the sanctions. But after the November elections brought gains for the Democrats in Congress, Bush doubled American military forces in the Gulf to 500,000, creating what was now clearly an offensive force rather than a defensive one. According to Elizabeth Drew, a writer for The New Yorker, Bush's aide, John Sununu, was telling people that a short, successful war would be pure political gold for the president and would guarantee his re-election. Historian John Wiener, analyzing the domestic context of the war decision shortly afterward, wrote that Bush abandoned sanctions and chose war because his time frame was a political one set up by the approaching 1992 presidential elections. That and the long-time U.S. wish to have a decisive voice in the control of Middle East oil resources were the crucial elements in the decision to go to war against Iraq. Shortly after the war, as representatives of the 13 oil-producing nations were about to gather in Geneva, the business correspondent of the New York Times wrote, "By virtue of its military victory, the United States is likely to have more influence in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries than any industrial nation has ever exercised." But those motives were not presented to the American public. It was told that the United States wanted to liberate Kuwait from Iraqi control. The major media dwelled on this as a reason for war, without noting that other countries had been invaded without the United States showing such concern. East Timor by Indonesia, Iran by Iraq, Lebanon by Israel, Mozambique by South Africa, to say nothing of countries invaded by the United States itself, Grenada, Panama. The justification for war that seemed most compelling was that Iraq was on its way to building a nuclear bomb. But the evidence for this was very weak. Before the crisis over Kuwait, Western intelligence sources had estimated it would take Iraq 3 to 10 years to build a nuclear weapon. Even if Iraq could build a bomb in a year or two, which was the most pessimistic estimate, it had no delivery system to send it anywhere. Besides, Israel already had nuclear weapons, and the United States had perhaps 30,000 of them. The Bush administration was trying hard to develop a paranoia in the nation about an Iraqi bomb, which did not yet exist. Bush seemed determined to go to war. There had been several chances to negotiate an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait right after the invasion, including an Iraqi proposal reported on August 29 by Newsday correspondent Newt Royce. But there was no response from the United States. When Secretary of State James Baker went to Geneva to meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz, the instruction from Bush was no negotiations. Despite months of exhortation from Washington about the dangers of Saddam Hussein, Surveys showed that less than half of the public favored military action. In January 1991, Bush, apparently feeling the need for support, asked Congress to give him the authority to make war. This was not a declaration of war, as called for by the Constitution. But since Korea and Vietnam, that provision of the Constitution seemed dead. And even the strict constructionists on the Supreme Court, who prided themselves on taking the words of the Constitution literally and seriously, would not intervene. The debate in Congress was lively. At one point, a Senate speech was interrupted by protesters in the balcony shouting, "No blood for oil!" The protesters were hustled out by guards. It is likely that Bush was sure of having enough votes, or he would have launched the invasion without congressional approval. After all, the precedent for ignoring Congress and the Constitution had been set in Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, and Panama. The Senate voted for military action by only a few votes. The House supported the resolution by a larger majority. However, once Bush ordered the attack on Iraq, both houses, with just a few dissents, Democrats as well as Republicans, voted to support the war and support the troops. It was in mid-January 1991, after Saddam Hussein defied an ultimatum to leave Kuwait, that the U.S. launched its air war against Iraq. It was given the name Desert Storm. The government and the media had conjured up a picture of a formidable military power. But Iraq was far from that. The U.S. Air Force had total control of the air and could bomb at will. Not only that, U.S. officials had virtual total control of the airwaves. The American public was overwhelmed with television photos of smart bombs and confident statements that laser bombs were being guided with perfect precision to military targets. The major networks presented all of these claims without question or criticism. This confidence in smart bombs sparing civilians may have contributed to a shift in public opinion, from being equally divided on going to war to perhaps 85% support for the invasion. Perhaps more important in winning over public support was that once American military were engaged, it seemed to many people who had previously opposed military action that to criticize it now meant betraying the troops who were there. All over the nation, yellow ribbons were displayed as a symbol of support for the forces in Iraq. In fact, the public was being deceived about how smart the bombs being dropped on Iraqi towns were. After talking with former intelligence and Air Force officers, a correspondent for the Boston Globe reported that perhaps 40% of the laser-guided bombs dropped in Operation Desert Storm missed their targets. John Lehman, Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan, estimated there had been thousands of civilian casualties. The Pentagon officially had no figure on this. A senior Pentagon official told the Globe, "To tell you the truth, we're not really focusing on this question." A Reuters dispatch from Iraq described the destruction of a 73-room hotel in a town south of Baghdad and quoted an Egyptian witness. "They hit the hotel full of families, and then they came back to hit it again." Reuters reported that the air raids on Iraq first used laser-guided bombs, but within a few weeks turned to B-52s, which carried conventional bombs, meaning more indiscriminate bombing. American reporters were kept from seeing the war close up, and their dispatches were subject to censorship. Apparently, recalling how press reports of civilian casualties had affected public opinion during the Vietnam War, the U.S. government was taking no chances this time. A Washington Post reporter complained about the control of information, writing in January 22, 1991, "The bombing has involved dozens of high-flying B-52 bombers equipped with huge unguided munitions. But the Pentagon has not allowed interviews with B-52 pilots, shown videotapes of their actions, or answered any questions about the operations of an aircraft that is the most deadly and least accurate in the armada of more than 2,000 U.S. and Allied planes in the Persian Gulf region. In mid-February, U.S. planes dropped bombs on an air raid shelter in Baghdad at 4 in the morning, killing 400 to 500 people. An Associated Press reporter, who was one of the few allowed to go to the site, said, "Most of the recovered bodies were charred and mutilated beyond recognition. Some, clearly, were children." The Pentagon claimed it was a military target. But the AP reporter on the scene said, "No evidence of any military presence could be seen inside the wreckage." Other reporters who inspected the site agreed. After the war, 15 Washington News Bureau chiefs complained in a joint statement that the Pentagon exercised virtual total control over the American press during the Gulf War. But while it was happening, leading television news commentators behaved as if they were working for the United States government. For instance, CBS correspondent Dan Rather, perhaps the most widely seen of the TV newsmen, reported from Saudi Arabia on a film showing a laser bomb, this one dropped by British aircraft in support of the American war, hitting a marketplace and killing civilians. Rather's only comment was, "We can be sure that Saddam Hussein will make propaganda of these casualties." When the Soviet government tried to negotiate an end to the war, bringing Iraq out of Kuwait before the ground war could get underway, top CBS correspondent Leslie Stahl asked another reporter, "Isn't this the nightmare scenario? Aren't the Soviets trying to stop us?" Ed Siegel, TV reporter for the Boston Globe, February 23, 1991. The final stage of the war, barely 6 weeks after it had begun, was a ground assault which, like the air war, encountered virtually no resistance. With victory certain and the Iraqi army in full flight, U.S. planes kept bombing the retreating soldiers, who clogged the highway out of Kuwait City. A reporter called the scene a blazing hell, a gruesome testament. To the east and west, across the sand, lay the bodies of those fleeing. A Yale professor of military history, Michael Howard, writing in the New York Times, January 28, 1991, quoted the military strategist Clausewitz approvingly. "The fact that a bloody slaughter is a horrifying act must make us take war more seriously, but not provide an excuse for gradually blunting our swords in the name of humanity." Howard went on to say, "In this conflict of wills, the bottom line remains a readiness to kill and be killed." The human consequences of the war became shockingly clear after its end, when it was revealed that the bombings of Iraq had caused starvation, disease, and the deaths of tens of thousands of children. A UN team visiting Iraq immediately after the war reported that the recent conflict has wrought near apocalyptic results upon the infrastructure. Most means of modern life support have been destroyed or rendered tenuous. A Harvard medical team reporting in May said that child mortality had risen steeply and that 55,000 more children died in the first 4 months of the year, the war lasted from January 15 to February 28, than in a comparable period the year before. The director of a pediatric hospital in Baghdad told a New York Times reporter that on the first night of the bombing campaign, the electricity was knocked out. Mothers grabbed their children out of incubators, took intravenous tubes out of their arms. Others were removed from oxygen tents and they ran to the basement where there was no heat. I lost more than 40 prematures in the first 12 hours of the bombing. Although in the course of the war, Saddam Hussein had been depicted by U.S. officials in the press as another Hitler, the war ended short of a march into Baghdad, leaving Hussein in power. It seemed that the United States had wanted to weaken him, but not to eliminate him, in order to keep him as a balance against Iran. In the years before the Gulf War, the United States had sold arms to both Iran and Iraq, at different times favoring one or the other as part of the traditional balance of power strategy. Therefore, as the war ended, the United States did not support Iraqi dissidents who wanted to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein. A New York Times dispatch from Washington, datelined March 26, 1991, reported, "President Bush has decided to let President Saddam Hussein put down rebellions in his country without American intervention, rather than risk the splintering of Iraq, according to official statements and private briefings today." This left the Kurdish minority, which was rebelling against Saddam Hussein, helpless. And anti-Hussein elements among the Iraqi majority were also left hanging. The Washington Post reported, May 3, 1991, "Major defections from the Iraqi military were in the offing in March at the height of the Kurdish rebellion, but never materialized because the officers concluded the U.S. would not back the uprising." The man who had been Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, a month after the end of the Gulf War, gave a cold assessment of the pluses and minuses of the event. "The benefits are undeniably impressive. First, a blatant act of aggression was rebuffed and punished. Second, U.S. military power is henceforth likely to be taken more seriously. Third, the Middle East and Persian Gulf region is now clearly an American sphere of preponderance." Brzezinski, however, was concerned about some negative consequences. One of them was that the very intensity of the air assault on Iraq gives rise to concern that the conduct of the war may come to be seen as evidence that Americans view Arab lives as worthless. And that raises the moral question of the proportionality of response. His point about Arab lives being seen as worthless was underlined by the fact that the war provoked an ugly wave of anti-Arab racism in the United States, with Arab Americans insulted or beaten or threatened with death. There were bumper stickers that said, "I don't break for Iraqis." An Arab-American businessman was beaten in Toledo, Ohio. Brzezinski's measured assessment of the Gulf War could be taken as close to representing the view of the Democratic Party. It went along with the Bush administration. It was pleased with the results. It had some misgivings about civilian casualties, but it did not constitute an opposition. President George Bush was satisfied. As the war ended, he declared on a radio broadcast, "The specter of Vietnam has been buried forever in the desert sands of the Arabian Peninsula." The establishment press very much agreed. The two leading news magazines, Time and Newsweek, had special editions hailing the victory in the war, noting there had been only a few hundred American casualties, without any mention of Iraqi casualties. A New York Times editorial, March 30, 1991, said, "Americans' victory in the Persian Gulf War provided special vindication for the U.S. Army, which brilliantly exploited its firepower and mobility, and in the process erased memories of its grievous difficulties in Vietnam." A black poet in Berkeley, California, June Jordan, had a different view. "I suggest to you it's a hit the same way the crack is, and it doesn't last long." Chapter 22, The Unreported Resistance. In the early 1990s, a writer for the New Republic magazine, reviewing with approval in the New York Times a book about the influence of dangerously unpatriotic elements among American intellectuals, warned his readers of the existence of a permanent adversarial culture in the United States. It was an accurate observation. despite the political consensus of Democrats and Republicans in Washington, which set limits on American reform, making sure that capitalism was in place, that national military strength was maintained, that wealth and power remained in the hands of a few. There were millions of Americans, probably tens of millions, who refused, either actively or silently, to go along. Their activities were largely unreported by the media. They constituted this permanent adversarial culture. The Democratic Party was more responsive to these Americans, on whose votes it depended. But its responsiveness was limited by its own captivity to corporate interests, and its domestic reforms were severely limited by the system's dependency on militarism and war. Thus, President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in the 60s became a victim of the war in Vietnam, and Jimmy Carter could not go far so long as he insisted on a huge outlay of money for the military, much of this to stockpile more nuclear weapons. As these limits became clear in the Carter years, a small but determined movement against nuclear arms began to grow. The pioneers were a tiny group of Christian pacifists who had been active against the Vietnam War. Among them were a former priest, Philip Berrigan, and his wife, Elizabeth McAllister, a former nun. Again and again, members of this group would be arrested for engaging in nonviolent acts of dramatic protest against nuclear war at the Pentagon and the White House, trespassing on forbidden areas, pouring their own blood on symbols of the war machine. In 1980, small delegations of peace activists from all over the country maintained a series of demonstrations at the Pentagon, in which over 1,000 people were arrested for acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. In September of that year, Philip Berrigan, his brother Daniel, the Jesuit priest and poet, Molly Rush, a mother of six, Anne Montgomery, a nun and counselor to young runaways and prostitutes in Manhattan, and four of their friends, made their way past a guard in the General Electric plant at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, where nose cones for nuclear missiles were manufactured. They used sledgehammers to smash two of the nose cones and smeared their own blood over missile parts, blueprints, and furniture. Arrested, sentenced to years in prison, they said they were trying to set an example to do as the Bible suggested, to beat swords into plowshares. They pointed to the huge allocations of taxpayers' money to corporations producing weaponry. GE drains $3 million a day from the public treasury, an enormous larceny against the poor. Before their trial, they came to be known as the Plowshares Eight. Daniel Berrigan had written in the Catholic Worker, "I know of no sure way of predicting where things will go from there, whether others will hear and respond, or how quickly or slowly, or whether the act will fail to vitalize others, will come to a grinding halt then and there, its actors stigmatized or dismissed as fools. One swallows dry and takes a chance." In fact, the movement did not come to a halt. Over the next decade, a national movement against nuclear weapons developed, from a small number of men and women willing to go to jail to make others stop and think, to millions of Americans frightened at the thought of nuclear holocaust, indignant at the billions of dollars spent on weaponry while people were in need of life's necessities. Even the very middle American Pennsylvania jurors who convicted the Plowshares Eight showed remarkable sympathy with their actions. One juror, Michael DeRosa, told a reporter, "I didn't think they really went to commit a crime. They went to protest." Another, Mary Ann Ingram, said, "The jury argued about that. We really didn't want to convict them on anything, but we had to because of the way the judge said the thing you can use is what you get under the law." She added, "These people are not criminals. Here are people who are trying to do some good for the country. But the judge said nuclear power wasn't the issue." Reagan's huge military budget was to provoke a national movement against nuclear weapons. In the election of 1980 that brought him into the presidency, local referenda in three districts in western Massachusetts permitted voters to say whether they believed in a mutual Soviet-American halt to testing, production, and deployment of all nuclear weapons, and wanted Congress to devote those funds instead to civilian use. Two peace groups had worked for months on the campaign, and all three districts approved the resolution, 94,000 to 65,000, even those that voted for Reagan as president. Similar referenda received majority votes between 1978 and 1981 in San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, Madison, and Detroit. Women were in the forefront of the new anti-nuclear movement. Randall Forsberg, a young specialist in nuclear arms, organized the Council for a Nuclear Weapons Freeze, whose simple program, a mutual Soviet-American freeze on the production of new nuclear weapons, began to catch on throughout the country. Shortly after Reagan's election, 2,000 women assembled in Washington, marched on the Pentagon, and surrounded it in a great circle, linking arms or stretching to hold the ends of brightly colored scarves. 140 women were arrested for blocking the Pentagon entrance. A small group of doctors began to organize meetings around the country to teach citizens the medical consequences of nuclear war. They were the core of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Helen Caldicott, the group's president, became one of the most powerful and eloquent national leaders of the movement. At one of their public symposia, Howard Hyatt, dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, gave a graphic description of the results of one 20-megaton nuclear bomb falling on Boston. 2 million people would die. Survivors would be burned, blinded, crippled. In a nuclear war, there would be 25 million severe burn cases in the nation, yet all existing facilities could care for only 200 cases. At a national meeting of Catholic bishops early in the Reagan administration, the majority opposed any use of nuclear weapons. In November 1981, there were meetings on 151 college campuses around the country on the issue of nuclear war. And at local elections in Boston that month, a resolution calling for increased federal spending on social programs, by reducing the amount of our tax dollars spent on nuclear weapons and programs of foreign intervention, won a majority in every one of Boston's 22 wards, including both white and black working-class districts. On June 12, 1982, the largest political demonstration in the history of the country took place in Central Park, New York City. Close to 1 million people gathered to express their determination to bring an end to the arms race. Scientists who had worked on the atom bomb added their voices to the growing movement. George Kistiakowsky, a Harvard University chemistry professor who had worked on the first atomic bomb and later was science advisor to President Eisenhower, became a spokesman for the disarmament movement. His last public remarks before his death from cancer at the age of 82 were in an editorial for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in December 1982. "I tell you as my parting words, forget the channels. There simply is not enough time left before the world explodes. Concentrate instead on organizing with so many others of like mind, a mass movement for peace such as there has not been before." By the spring of 1983, the nuclear freeze had been endorsed by 368 city and county councils across the country, by 444 town meetings and 17 state legislatures, and by the House of Representatives. A Harris poll at this time indicated that 79% of the population wanted a nuclear freeze agreement with the Soviet Union. Even among evangelical Christians, a group of 40 million people presumed to be conservative and pro-Reagan, A Gallup poll sampling showed 60% favoring a nuclear freeze. A year after the Great Central Park demonstration, there were over 3,000 anti-war groups around the country. And the anti-nuclear feeling was